Chapter 3. A Midnight Sun. After this, all battles will be easy, all victories simple, all glories hollow. General Notches Sturm, after his victory on Grimoire. The bombardment continued, both day and night, for 2.5 weeks. By the close of the 12th day, day and night were barely distinguishable, so great was the atmospheric smoke haze hanging around Vervenhive. The shield held firm, but the southern outhabs and manufactories became a fire-blown wasteland, 50 kilometers square. Some shelling had also been deliberately ranged over the shield, catastrophically wounding the unprotected northern districts and large sections of the Haas docklands. On the afternoon of the 6th day, Marshal Edric Crow, the legislature's appointed successor to Nide, ordered the closing of the southern hive gates. The new marshal, brother of Lord Crow of that noble house, had been a serving major colonel in Vervan Primary, and his election was ratified by 7 of the 9 noble houses. Noble House Anko, who were sponsoring their own general, Hesketh Anko, for the post, voted to deny. Noble House Chass abstained. Marshal Crow was a pale, white-haired giant, well over 2 meters tall. His fierce black eyes and hard gaze were the subject of barrack legend, but he was personally calm, quiet, and inspirational, judicious in leadership, and popular with the men. The majority vote of the noble houses reflected their confidence in him, and the fact they felt he would remain answerable to them in all circumstances. Hesketh Anko, a plump, swarthy brute who approached war politically rather than tactically, was appointed Crow's chief of staff to appease House Anko. The two did not get on, and their furious arguments in House Command became notorious. Crow's decision to close the gates, at this stage there were still some 500,000 refugees streaming in from the southern districts seeking sanctuary at Haas West, Sondar, and Crow Gates, surprised the houses and the legislature as a whole. Many believed Crow had bowed to Anko's persistent pressure. House Chass, House Rodian, and 7 houses ordinary raised a bill of disapproval and railed against the cruelty of the action. 500,000 left to die, the gates sealed against them.
"It defies humanity," Lord Rodian stated in the hall of the legislature.
In fact, Marshal Crow's decision had been far more deeply affected by the advice of Commissar Cowell, who had returned from the front line with the tattered remnants of the tank divisions on the second night. Despite the losses suffered by Vegolaine's forces, Cowell was hailed by many as a hero. He had single-handedly rallied more than 30 vehicles and crews and pulled them back, bringing first-hand details of the enemy home to the hive. The public address plates spoke freely of his heroism and loyalty. His name was chanted in the refugee camps and in all gatherings of citizens and workers. The title People's Hero was coined and stuck. It was popularly believed he would be decorated for his actions, and many in the low classes saw him as a folk hero and a better choice for Marshal than Crow. When, on the 9th day, food, water, and energy rationing was imposed hive-wide by the legislature, a speech by Cal was published on the address plates, stating how he would not only be observing rationing strictly, but also rationing his rations. This astute piece of propaganda was Cal's idea, and the hive population almost universally embraced the restrictions, wishing to be true to the people's hero and his selfless behavior. Crow realized quickly that he should not underestimate Cal's power as a popular figure, but that also meant he couldn't ignore Cal's tactical suggestions out of hand. Crow, Anko, and the assembled officer elite spent most of the 5th day in conference. They filled the briefing hall of House Command in the main spine to capacity. An expectant hush fell on the assembled soldiers when Crow asked Cowell to give his assessment of the opposition. Cowell rose to his feet, the shrapnel wound in his forehead clearly and crudely suited, another carefully judged move on Cowell's part.
"I cannot overstate the magnitude of the enemy," Cowell said, his calm voice carried around the vast, domed hall by hovering drones. "I have seldom seen a military force of such scale. 80,000 or 90,000 armored vehicles, thousands of gun batteries, and an infantry force behind them of several million." The hall was deadly quiet.
Marshal Crowe asked the Commissar to confirm what he had just said. During the Trade War, 90 years before, Vervenhive had faced a Zoican army of 900,000 and barely survived.
Millions, Cal repeated simply. In all the confusion, I had little opportunity to make a head count, of course.
General laughter welled from the officer cadre.
But I am sure, by disposition alone, that at least 5 million troops were embarked in file behind the armor advance. And those were only the ones I could see.
Preposterous, Vice Marshal Anko barked. Vervenhive supports over 40 million in Habs, and from that we raise 500,000 troops. Zoika is a third our size. How could they conceivably field 5 or more million troops?
I repeat only what I saw, General.
There was hubbub and murmuring in the officer ranks. Crowe had requested orbital pictures prior to the meeting, pictures he had hoped would confirm or deny these outlandish claims. But the smoke patterns from the continued bombardment were blanketing the continent, and nothing was discernible. He had to trust Cal's estimation, an estimation supported by many of the armor crews he had brought back with him. Crowe also had to consider the political and popular suicide of contradicting the people's hero. Crowe cleared his throat, and his dark eyes fixed the Commissar across the central chart table.
Your recommendations, Commissar?
The south gates to the Hive must be closed. Sooner or later, the bombardment will stop. Then the Zoican legions will descend on us in unprecedented force. Already they may be approaching, cloaked by the barrage, entering the southern districts. We must make ourselves secure.
Crowe was silent. His gate officers had brought him updates on the refugee intake, the miserable statistics of the dispossessed and wounded still pressing for entry after 5 days. But Cal's assessment was inarguable.
The southern gates will close tomorrow at 9.
Crowe hoped he would not live to regret this callous act. As a matter of record, he would not. While the magnitude of this decision soaked into the stunned officers, Colonel Modile requested that the wall artillery be raised and armed. At the first alarm, the rampart defences had been manned and raised, but more potent, heavy guns, dormant since the trade war, were still muzzled in deployment silos in the curtain wall itself. Vice Marshal Anko reported that this work was already underway. The Hive's main firepower would be ready in 2 more days, and at last the city would have long-range artillery to answer the bombardment.
What of the reinforcements Highmaster Sondar promised?
Asked an artillery officer on the front bench.
10 regiments of auxiliaries are moving south to us from the northern foundry collectives as we speak. Vanik Hive has promised us 9 regiments within a week.
At the request to the Imperium?
Asked Commissar Tarion, head of the VPHC. Crowe smiled.
The will of the Emperor is with us. Warmaster Makaroth has already responded to our needs. Ordinarily his forces would be months away, but luck is on our side. A troop convoy from Monthax, regrouping to reinforce the Warmaster's main crusade assault into the Cabal systems, is just 9 days away. It has been rerouted. 6 regiments of guard infantry and 3 armor groups are moving to us directly.
There was general noise and some cheers. Crowe rose and hushed them all.
But that is still 9 days away. We must be strong. We must be fast. We must be secure. Well before then. The south gates close at 9 tomorrow.
A pitiful semblance of dawn was ebbing through the smoke cover when the Hieronymo Sondar gate shut the next morning. Dozens of refugees scrambled through in the last few moments. Dozens more were crushed by the slamming hydraulics. At West Hass and Crow gates, the story was repeated. Vervea gate had been immobilized by the first night's shelling, although the railhead fires were now out. Vervan primary battalions, supervised by the VPHC, erected blockades of metal wreckage to close the gate, the commissariat officers ordering the troops to fire on any refugees still trying to gain access. The piteous screaming and wailing of those shut outside was more than some Vervan primary troopers could bear. Many wrote in letters or journals that it was the worst part of the whole campaign for them. Soldiers, who had overseen the closing of the gates at the start of the sixth day, and who survived the entire ordeal, never forgot that moment. Years after, men woke in the night, or at grey daybreak, sweating and screaming, echoing the noises they heard from outside the walls. It was the most merciless act of the conflict so far, and it would only be matched when the gates fell open again, over a month later. The Vervenhive wall artillery began firing just before noon on the eighth day. The massive silos opened their ceramite shutters and volleyed shells back into the salt grass hinterland, where the enemy forces were massing. The salvos were answered with redoubled bombardment from the still unseen foe. On the morning of the 11th day, troop convoys began to thread down the motor routes north of the Haas. 20,000 men and nearly 5,000 war machines sent out from the northern collectives to reinforce Vervenhive, or, more particularly, the Haas crossing, which protected them from the Zeuken advance. Kicking dust, the troop carriers and tanks rumbled through the bombed outer Habs and damaged manufactories, braving the bombardment that still fell across the river from far away. Thousands of citizens had fled across the river by ferry, some trying to reach their homes in the northern outer Habs, many more seeking sanctuary in the northern collectives. In places, the mass of people on the roadways slowed the North Col advance, but VPHC details were sent across the river by Vice Marshal Anko to clear the way. By the afternoon, the North Col regiments were moving freely down to the waiting ferries at the docks, all refugee columns driven into the roadside fields to allow the convoys to pass. Some 300 refugees had been executed by the VPHC to force them to make way. The refugees jeered the North Col columns as they roared past. General Zants of the North Col's second enforcers later wrote, "This humiliating greeting did more to burn out the North Col morale than a month of bitter resistance at the wall." Such was the size of the North Col deployment, and such was the capacity of the ferries, that estimates suggested it would take 4 days to cross them over the Haas into Vervenhive. When told of this, Marshal Crow ordered the Haas viaduct reopened so that rail links could resume. The rail route had been closed at the start of the bombardment. Bypassing the ferry route, North Col got its forces into the Hive in just under 2 days. Many tanks and armoured personnel carriers actually crossed the viaduct under their own power, trundling along the rail tracks. Two divisions of the North Col infantry also marched across the viaduct in a break between trains. So far, nothing had been heard of the promised reinforcements from Vanik Hive, the great refinery collective 3,000 kilometres away to the east. Vanik had undertaken to provide 9 regiments, but thus far the only thing that had come from them was the continued fuel oil supplies carried by the eastern pipeline. Many in Vervenhive wondered if the forces of Zeuke had reached them too. At dawn on the 14th day, lights were seen in the upper atmosphere. Flaring their braking jets, Imperial Guard dropships descended, diverted to the main lift port at Kanak in the northern collective Hives. With the shield erected, Vervenhive's central landing field could accept no ships. The Imperial Guard disembarked at Kanak and then marched south on the tail of the North Col forces. The simple sight of their high-orbit adjustments and blazing descents lifted the morale of the battered Hive. The Guard was coming. The Royal Volpone 1st, 2nd, and 4th deployed south from Kanak Port swiftly, using the rail link to bring themselves deep into the Hive. Marshal Crow personally greeted General Notches Sturm, the decorated victor of Grimoire, on the rock-crete platform of the North Spine Terminus. A large crowd of politically approved citizens cheered them under the watchful eyes of the VPHC. Dressed in shimmering blue gowns, daughters of the noble houses, Merity Chass, Alina Anko, Iona Gavunda, and Murdith Crow amongst them, were sent forward to decorate Sturm and his second officers, Colonels Gilbert and Corday, with silk floral wreaths. Sturm was also greeted by the famous Commissar Cowell. The image of their smiling handshake was repeated on 1 million public address plates across the Hive. The 5th and 7th regiments of the Rowan Deepers, under General Nash, arrived by rail later that afternoon, amid more pantomime celebrations. Vice Marshal Anko was there to greet Nash, and brass bands pomped and trumpeted the arrival. Amid the jubilation, Nash was able to confirm that three full regiments of Narmenian armour were offloading from carriers at the Kanak port landing fields and would be en route south by dawn. The crowd rose, cheering the news, hailing the honoured guard arrivals like they had already won the war. The Tanith First and Only arrived by road, almost unnoticed, two nights later. More than 80 matte-black troop trucks rumbled down the North Col Highway through the northern outhabs of Vervenhive. The canvas tilts had been removed, and around 30 Tanith troopers rode in each, crouched down with their weapons, webbing, haversacks, musette bags and bedrolls gathered to them. The bouncing trucks, six-wheelers with large, snarling front grills and pop-eye headlamps, bore the quadruple chevron cab marks of North Col Utility Transport Division 3. Jerrycans and spare wheels were slung to their sides on sponson fittings. A dozen outriders astride black drab motorcycles ran along their flanks, and behind the main column came 30 more high-cabbed eight-wheelers laden with ammunition crates and regimental supplies, as well as the numerous cooks, armourers, mechanics, servitors, and other attendant hangers-on that followed a guard regiment on the move. These freighters were dull yellow, the livery of the Kanak Port Cargo Union, and netting was draped over their payloads. North Col soldiers in pale blue overalls and forage caps drove all the trucks, but the outriders were Tanith in their distinctive dark battle dress. 12 kilometres short of Vervenhive, they paused to trickle through a checkpoint on the highway, and they gained a vanguard of two dark blue staff cars, crewed by VPHC officers to lead them in. All the headlamps in the convoy were blazing. Night had fallen some time, unnoticed in the thick wallow of smoke. The only sights were the battered districts to either side, the fuzzy green glow of the hive itself, partly obscured by the smoke, and the occasional flash and flare of long-range shells falling into the outer habs they raced through. Bryn Milo, the youngest ghost, rode with the rest of Number 1 Platoon in the lead truck. A slender, pale youth, just now filling out with adult bulk, he had been the only non-soldier saved from the ruins of Tanith when their homeworld was overrun and destroyed 4 years earlier. The Commissar himself had saved his life and dragged him from the fires that burned Tanith away. For a long while, he had been the boy, the company mascot, the piper, a little piece of Tanith innocence saved from hell, a reminder to all of the men of the place they had lost. But 6 months before, during the battle for Monthax, he had finally become a soldier, too. He was proud of his issued equipment and lasgun, and he kept his pack in better order than any of the seasoned Tanith troopers. He sat huddled in the cramped rear bay of the rattling truck and polished the regimental crest on his black beret with a rag of gun cloth.
Milo.
Bryn looked up at Trooper Larkin opposite him. A wiry, taut-skinned man in his early 50s, Larkin was as well known for his neurotic personality as his skill as the regiment's most able sniper. The long, specialized shape of his marksman's lasgun was sheathed in a canvas roll at his feet. Larkin had produced his gun scope and was training it like a spyglass out of the truck. Larkin had once told Milo that he didn't trust anything he hadn't seen first through his beloved scope.
Larkin?
Larkin grinned and looked back, handing the delicate brass instrument to the youth, gently. From the tiny runes glowing on the setting dial, Milo noticed it was fixed to heat sea.
Take a look. That way.
Milo squinted into the scope, resting the rubberized cup to his eye socket. He saw radiance and bewildering crosshair markers of floating red.
What am I looking at?
The hive, boy. The hive.
Milo looked again. He realized the radiance was the yellow dome of the shield, a vast energy field that enveloped the unseen city hive ahead.
Looks big enough and ugly enough to look after itself, he suggested.
The same is said for so many of us,
Colonel Corbeck said, holding on to the truck's iron tilt hoops as he edged down to Milo and Larkin.
Velvet Hive is in a pretty fix, so they say.
That's Vervenhive, Chief,
Trooper Burren said from nearby.
That's you, clever ass,
Corbeck tossed back at the grinning soldier.
Feth knows I can barely remember my own name most days, let alone where I'm supposed to be.
First Platoon laughed. Milo held the scope up to Korbeck, who waved it off with disinterest.
I'll meet the place that'll kill me when I meet it. Don't need to look for it in advance.
Milo gave the precious scope back to Larkin, who took a final look and then slid the instrument back into its drawstring bag.
Seen enough, Larks?
Korbeck asked, his vast arms gripping the overhead frame, his beard split by a toothy grin.
Seen enough to know where to aim, Larkin replied.
In the juddering load bay of the truck, three vehicles back, Third Platoon were all wagering on cards. Trooper Fagor, a dangerous lean man with hooded eyes, had bartered a full tarot pack from some administratum fellow on the troopship, and he was running a game of hearts and titans. Trooper Brostin, big, heavy-set and saturnine, had lost so much already he was ready to wager his flamer, with the fuel tanks, as his next lay-down. Fagor, a thick cigar clenched between his sharp teeth, laughed at Brostin's discomfiture and shuffled the pack again. As he flicked the big pasteboard cards out into hands around the grilled deck, the men of the platoon produced coins, crumpled notes, rings, and tobacco rations to add to the pot. Trooper Caffron watched him deal. Short, young, and determined, just a year older than Milo, Caffron had gained the respect of them all during the beach assault at Oscray about a year before. Caffron disliked cards, but in Rawn's platoon it paid to mix in. Major Rawn sat at the end of the truck bay, his back to the rear wall of the cab. The Tanith second officer, he was infamous for his anger, guile, and pessimism. Korbeck had likened him to a snake more than once, both physically and in character.
"Will you play, Major?"
Fagor asked, his hands hesitating on the deal. Rawn shook his head. He'd lost plenty to his adjutant in the last 40 days of transit in the troopship. Now he could smell war, and idle gaming had lost its interest. Fagor shrugged and finished the deal. Caffran picked up his hand and sighed. Brostin picked up his hand and sighed more deeply. He wondered if wool socks would count as a wager. The outriders raced around the speeding trucks, gunning for the destination. Sergeant McColl, head of the scout platoon, crossed his bike in between two of the troop vehicles and rode down the edge gully so he could take a look at the hive emerging out of the smoke before them. It was big, bigger than any city he'd ever seen, bigger than the bastion towns of Tanith, certainly. He roared ahead, passing the staff cars of the local commissariat, until he was leading the column down the broken highway towards the docks. A volley of shells fell in the outhabs to the east. Dawdon, the grizzled elderly chief medic of the Tanith Regiment, heaved himself up to see. Conflagrations, bright and bitter lemon in color, sizzled out from the distant detonations. The truck sashayed into a pothole, and Dawdon was dropped on his arse.
"Why bother?"
Bragg asked.
"Say again," asked the doctor.
Bragg shifted his position in the flatbed, uncomfortably. He was huge, bigger than any other two ghosts put together.
"We'll get there sooner or later. Die there sooner or later. Why bother craning for a view of our doom?"
Dawdon looked across at the giant.
"Is the cup half full or half empty, Bragg?" he asked.
"What cup?"
"It's hypothetical. Half full or half empty."
"Yeah, but what cup are we talking about?"
"An imaginary cup."
"What's in it?"
"That doesn't matter."
"Does to me, Doc."
Bragg shrugged.
"Well, okay. It's got sacra in it. Half full or half empty."
"How much sacra?"
Bragg asked. Dawdon opened his mouth once, twice, then sat back again.
"Doesn't matter."
Bragg pulled out a canvas bottle flask.
"There's sacra in this,"
he announced.
"Thanks, not just yet,"
Dawdon said, raising his hands as if in surrender. Bragg sat opposite him in the shuddering truck, nodded and took a long swig. Shells wailed down, half a kilometer from the road, close enough to be uncomfortable. Dawdon reached out for the flask.
"Ah, well, if it's there."
Sergeant Vall, gripping the iron hand loops of the truck's flatbed with his whirring mechanical limb, tried to rouse the spirits of his platoon by encouraging a song. A few of them joined unenthusiastically with a verse or two of Over the Sky and Far Away, but it soon faltered. When Val tried another, he was told to shut up, to his face. Sergeant Val handled people better than most of the officers in the regiment, and he knew when to reprimand and when to back off. He'd been a dog soldier himself for long enough. But the mood in his platoon was bad, and Val knew why. No one wanted this. No one wanted to get in the middle of a hive war. The Magnificat was waiting at the northern docks as the column rolled in out of the firelit night. All the Haas ferries were working full stretch to keep the river open, and convoy after convoy of military supplies and ammunition were arriving each hour from the northern collectives. Troops from Vervin Primary, in blue greycoats, grey webbing, and the distinctive spiked helmets, along with VPHC men, servitors, and a good few red-robed clerks and overseers from the Administratum, were now controlling the river freight, much to the fury of the regular longshoremen of the Dockmaster Guild. Ecclesiarchy priests had also arrived on the third or fourth day, establishing a permanent prayer vigil to protect the crossing and make the waterway and the viaduct safe. The hooded clergy were grouped around a brazier at a pier end, chanting and intoning. They were there each time Follick drew the Magnificat back to the North Shore wharves. It seemed they never slept, never rested. He got into the habit of nodding to them every time he slid the ferry in past them. They never responded. On this night run, Follick expected to take on more supply vehicles and crates, but the house troopers running the dockside had drawn the North Col freight trucks aside so that troop transports could move round them and roll down the landing stages. Follick nursed the ancient turbines into station keeping as Mincer dropped the ramp. The first two trucks growled and bounced aboard. Mincer directed them to their deck spaces with a pair of dagger lamps. A tall, long-coated figure dropped from the cab of the first truck. He approached longshoreman Follick. Follick was almost hypnotized by the commissar badge on the peaked cap. An awed smile creased his oil-spattered face, and he took off his wool cap out of respect.
"Sir, it's an honor to have you aboard."
"The pleasure's mine. What's your name?"
"Follick, Imperial Hero, sir."
I had no idea my reputation preceded me this far. "Greetings, Follick."
"It's a true honor, sir, to be able to transport your reinforcement column to Vervenhive."
"I appreciate the honor, Follick. My first vehicles are aboard. Shall we proceed?" Follick nodded and shuffled away to get Mincer to unlap the rope coils.
"Commissar Cowell himself uses our boat,"
gasped Follick to his crewmate.
"Cowell? Are you sure? The people's hero? It's him, I tell you. In the flesh, bald as old bastardy, right here on our tub."
At the rail, Colonel Commissar Ibram Gaunt gazed out from the deck of the Magnificat and smiled as he overheard the words. The Magnificat was in midstream when the eastern sky lit up brightly. There was a sucking shudder, like a windrush over the water. The eastern horizon blazed with a midnight sun.
"What was that?"
Mincer cried. A commotion rose from the troops. Gaunt raised his hand to shield his eyes from the glare as a heat wash rolled down the river. He knew the blast effects of a nuclear detonation when he saw it. "That was the beginning of the end," he said.